This morning we begin with a story of courage, a story of being confronted by others who might doubt, being confronted by skepticism and choosing to respond boldly. It's a story of a young man who defies all odds to successfully mount up with wings like eagles over the gnashing of teeth while seeming to walk on water. It's a story set in the good old days. One might even call them happy days. When Arthur Herbert Fonzarelli donned water skis and the Fonz jumped over a shark while still wearing his leather jacket. Those who love the show Happy Days will tell you the series was never quite the same after that moment. Seriously? Jumping a shark on water skis? It was such a significant moment, it created its own point of reference for other TV shows, and now trends and institutions all can be known to have jumped the shark. In fact, the phrase jump the shark gets a lot of use. Well, not as much use as the phrase got a couple years ago. I actually think the phrase jump the shark has jumped the shark. But the phrase was a quick and easy way to name that something that once was awesome has taken a turn it will never bounce back from. Losing what made it great to begin with. You see, we as people like having shared reference to draw from. This is harder and harder these days because there's like 8 billion channels. We don't all watch the same thing. There was a time when everyone would watch the same show or maybe choose from 3 that were on. And when people gathered together, we could talk about it because we all saw the same thing. But now it's, oh, don't talk about it. I'm watching it on Netflix and haven't seen it yet. You can't talk about that episode. Or, oh no, I was watching something on Animal Planet. I didn't see what was on Bravo. Oh, we're missing these moments of shared stories to go back to. We as people benefit from having shared reference, a place we can go and make a quick passing comment that implies so much more. Making a passing reference that alludes to all these things that we all might know and share together. All while letting us feel connected and a little bit like an insider. Sometimes these phrases stick around long after the memory of where they came from. People, actually, my little boy, I love Joey, he's got this crazy blonde hair, we're not sure where it came from. Everyone refers to him as a towhead. But no one really knows that that phrase came from when flax used to be prepared for spinning and it would soak and little pieces of the flax would separate out and the stuff on the top was this beautiful white, almost blondish color. Hence, towhead. Everyone took part in that process at a certain point in time and so people could use that phrase towhead and everybody knew what it meant. Now we just know it means little blonde kid, forgetting the flax. Now the reference still carries meaning, but not its original story. This happens in so many ways. For many generations, one of the most common and shared references for community was the Bible. They were stories people knew long before literacy was common. They were something that was a common reference. Everyone went to church, right? And everyone grew up with the Bible stories, the symbols, the motifs, the characters, and the conflicts of the Bible. So it was this very common reference. Anyone could just toss a line out and, you know, the whole story was implied. You know, forbidden fruit. Am I my brother's keeper? That's kind of a burning bush moment. Oh, aren't they just a good Samaritan? That one's a little bit of a lost sheep, if you know what I'm saying. Or someone who betrays you. Oh, you Judas! These are all biblical allusions, right? These things that are a part of our Christian and Jewish stories that we've carried forward. They carry all this meaning, but sometimes those connections get lost. These biblical allusions are all over the place if you know what you're listening for. But like so many of these other phrases that make their way into our day-to-day lives, sometimes the connection to the original story is forgotten. And such it is with the phrase, the writing was on the wall. I want to tell you a story. You see, in the Hebrew Bible, our Old Testament, you will find the book of Daniel. The book of Daniel tells the story of the life of Daniel. You're noticing a trend. Last week we talked about when judges were in charge and it was called Judges. Then there's that book where the kings are in charge and it's called Kings. This story about the life of Daniel comes from the book of Daniel. It's actually very convenient for tests in seminary. Daniel lived during a time when the Hebrew people lived under the rule of the Babylonians. Now, Daniel is most famous for that whole lion's den incident, in which he's thrown into a den full of lions for refusing to worship the king. Interestingly enough, the king that has him thrown in there really liked him. It wasn't the king's desire to do so, it was all the people who were jealous of how important Daniel was. Well, the story we look at today is one of the stories of how Daniel became so important. Hear this story. You see, King Belshazzar made a great festival for 1,000 of the royal lords. And the king was drinking wine in the presence of these 1,000. And under the influence of wine, you gotta love when the Bible opens a story that way. Under the influence of wine, Belshazzar commanded that everyone should bring in the vessels of gold and silver that his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem. So the kings, the lords, the wives, the concubines, everyone might drink from them at the party. So they brought in the vessels of gold and silver that had been taken from the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem. And the king and his lords, the wives, the concubines, they all started drinking from them. They drank the wine and they praised gods of silver and gold and bronze and iron and wood and stone. As all of this was going on, the fingers of a human hand appeared in their midst and began to write in the plaster on the wall of the royal palace, right next to the lampstand. The king was watching as the hand wrote, and the king's face turned pale, and the thoughts terrified him. His limbs gave way, his knees knocked together. The king cried out aloud to bring in enchanters and Chaldeans and diviners, and the king said to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever can read this writing and tell me what it means will be clothed in purple, given gold, and made the third most important person in the kingdom." So all of the king's wise men came, but they could not read the writing, nor could they tell the king an interpretation. Then King Belshazzar became greatly terrified, and his face again turned pale, and everyone was perplexed. Now, to keep this moving, I'm going to summarize about another page and a half of this story. The queen, for some reason, is the only person who remembers anything that happened in the first four chapters of the book of Daniel. Daniel was this amazing rock star, did great things for the king. It was great, and for some reason she's the only one who remembers this, and is like, "Hey, that guy Daniel, he used to handle problems like this. You should probably call him." Now we join the story again. Then Daniel was brought in before the king, and the king said to Daniel, "So, you're Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom my father brought here. I have heard that you have a spirit of the gods within you, and that enlightenment, understanding, and excellent wisdom are found in you. All of the wise men and the enchanters have been brought in to read this writing and tell me its interpretation, but they were not able to tell me anything. But I heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Now, if you're able to read the writing and tell me what it means, you shall be clothed in purple, given a chain of gold around your neck, and rank third in this kingdom." Then Daniel answered in the presence of the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself, or give the rewards to someone else. Nevertheless, I will read the writing for you, O king, and let you know the interpretation." Now again, I'm going to tighten this up a little bit. Daniel goes on for quite some time. He has the audience of the king, and he wants to tell the king how much he screwed up. So Daniel really goes through multiple paragraphs of up one side and down the other, how the king has really screwed everything up. He's made some really bad decisions, things the previous king didn't do, because the previous king had a little bit of respect for Daniel's God. Then he continues here. "You have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven. The vessels of his temple have been brought in before you, and you and the lords and your wives and the concubines, you're drinking wine from them? You've praised gods of silver, gold, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. You don't even know those things, but the God whose power is in your very breath and to whom belong all ways, that's the one God you don't honor? So from that presence, that divine presence, that God sent the hand that was writing on this wall. And this is what the writing says. Mene, mene, tekel, parson. And I will offer you an interpretation of this matter, O king. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. Peres, your kingdom will be divided and given to the Medes and the Persians." Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed in purple. A chain of gold was put around his neck, and a proclamation was made that concerning Daniel, he now ranked third in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, the king, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom. Now, I didn't actually abridge that ending. I really trimmed up some other things in the story. That's really how this chapter ends. All of this story, and then it just is, and that night, the king was killed. Boom, king's dead. Guess he should have read the writing on the wall. Our use of the writing on the wall as a colloquialism does a pretty good job of summarizing one of the key lessons of this story. Sometimes there are things that tell us what is going to happen in life. We just don't understand them at the time. I mean, this is a very real human experience. How many times have we found ourselves in a situation we wish we could have avoided, only to realize we could have avoided it if we'd noticed the warning signs, the hints, and the clues of what was to come? But we didn't see them then. At least we didn't understand them then. See, but what our contemporary use of this phrase, the writings on the wall, what it leaves out, is that the king actually noticed the writing on the wall and did his best to read and understand it. He really gets an A for effort. I can just hear some opinionated observer as the king lays there dying, "The writing was on the wall, Your Highness." And I can just hear the king snarking back with his dying breath, "I know. I saw it. I called every dream interpreter, magician, soothsayer, and mystic in the kingdom, found the one person who could actually understand it, and had him translate it for me, and here we are anyway." Okay, really deep dying breath. But I mean, what is he supposed to say in this moment? As outlandish as this story is, this is the moment that I think we can see the Bible telling us that it's people like us looking at things when they've fallen apart, wishing we would have known sooner. That's a human experience. Even in the midst of all of the outlandish stories of floating hands and other things, and trust me, the book of Daniel is filled with stories that challenge our experience of reality. Just one chapter before, King Nebuchadnezzar actually gets transformed into a mountain goat and has to spend a few days climbing around in the high country to learn humility before he's transformed back into a human. And then, of course, this story, we've got that, you know, mysterious disembodied hand writing on the wall. When we encounter stories like these in the Bible, it's far too easy and often tempting to just write them off. Okay, sure. Cute, crazy Bible story. It's also far too easy for us to belittle the people who first believed them, the people who chose to record them. It's easy for us to think, oh, those are simple-minded people from a less intellectual time. I encourage you not to do that. Stories such as these, they tell us about the great strength and the great faith of a people who hadn't seen their promised land, their home, in generations. People who spent more time under oppressive rule than living free, all the while holding fast to their identity as God's chosen people, seeking God's will in the midst of it. While at the same time, I also encourage you not to do mental gymnastics and logical backflips trying to prove that such stories as these are literally true. Oh, it literally happened exactly that way, I'm sure. And this is how I can make that happen. I mean, especially when the names of many of the royalty don't actually appear outside the biblical record, how the timelines shared don't always match up with other parts of history. And for goodness sakes, there was a disembodied hand writing on the wall. We don't need to do mental gymnastics to try to prove it happened literally. But if we're not going to write them off and we don't try to justify them literally, what are we to do with these stories? We're to learn from them. We're to learn from them. These are stories filled with lessons for us. In this story, we learn that it is not wise to forget the lessons learned by people who came before us, or forget people who have helped those before us learn important things. Seriously, Nebuchadnezzar had learned every single lesson that would have saved King Belshazzar if he'd only paid attention to the things his father had learned and the traditions before him. In our story today, we're reminded that prophets in the Bible don't tell the future like with a crystal ball, but they point out what are the most likely results if current behavior isn't changed. It's what the parenting books I love call natural consequences. Well, yeah, that was going to happen. How did you not see that? That's what the role of the prophet is. And when we hear people in our lives reminding us, you know where this is heading, right? Hear a prophetic word. In our story today, we also learn that even when we recognize there is writing on the wall, sometimes it's too late to do anything about it. So we're invited to think about what our actions will lead us to before we do them, instead of just worrying afterwards once the consequences start to appear. We learn not just from the story itself, but the fact that the story was included in our scriptures teaches us something. The fact that this story is in the Bible teaches us something. It affirms that we as people, we need to know that God is working for us in tough times. To a people in exile, watching everything holy to them be desecrated, this was a story of hope. God was still with them. God was still watching out. God is still taking care of things and will bring and fulfill the promises offered. Stories of God righting the wrongs of this world bring hope to those who still cry out, "How long must we wait?" God is active and involved. The stories of Daniel and so many other biblical characters, stories of our biblical heroes, they carry forward a narrative as old as creation. God is still at work. It's a story the Hebrew people needed to hear during their exile, and I believe it's a story that God's people still need to hear today. God is still at work. Even when things seem wrong, even when things seem unjust, even when things seem like they'll never be able to change, God is still at work. God is seeking to guide us. God is seeking to right those wrongs, to bend that arc of the universe towards justice. God is seeking relationships with the most unlikely of people to bring that justice forward. God is at work even in the most difficult of circumstances. How do I know this? We'll stop and look. We will find that the writing is on the wall. Amen.